wurde sie hin? Zen is a very extraordinary growth. Rarely such a possibility becomes actuality, because many hazards are involved. Many times before, the possibility has existed that a certain spiritual happening could have grown and become like Zen, but it was never realized to its totality. Only once in the whole history of human consciousness a thing like Zen has come into being. It is very rare. So first I would like you to understand what Zen is, because unless you do that, these anecdotes won't be of much help. You need to know the complete background. In that background, in that context, these anecdotes become luminous. Suddenly, you attend to the meaning and the significance of them. Otherwise, they are separate units. You can enjoy them, or sometimes you can laugh at them. They are very poetic. In themselves, they are beautiful, unique pieces of art. But just by looking at these anecdotes, you will not be able to penetrate to the significance of what Zen is. So first try to follow me slowly through the growth of Zen, how it happened. Zen was born in India, grew in China, and blossomed in Japan. The whole situation is rare. Why it happened that it was born in India but could not grow here? Had to seek a different soil. It became a great tree in China, but could not blossom there. Had to seek again a new climate, a different climate. And in Japan, it blossomed like a cherry tree in thousands of flowers. It is not coincidental. It is not accidental. It has a deep inner history. I would like it to reveal to you. India is an introvert country. Japan is extrovert, and China is just in the middle of these two extremes. India and Japan are absolutely opposites. So how come that the seed was born in India and blossomed in Japan? They are opposites. They have no similarities. They are contradictory. And why China comes just in the middle to give soil to it? A seed is an introversion. Try to understand the phenomena of the seed. What a seed is. A seed is not outgoing. a seed has really turned upon itself. A seed is an introvert phenomenon. It is centripetal. The energy is moving inwards. That's why it is a seed, covered and closed from the outer world completely. In fact, seed is the loneliest, most isolated thing in the world. It has no roots in the soil, no branches in the sky, no connection with the earth, no connection with the sky. In fact, it has no relationships around it. A seed is an absolute island, isolated, caved in. It does not relate. It has a hard cell around it. There are no windows, no doors. It cannot go out, nothing can come in. Seed is natural to India. The genius of India can produce seeds of tremendous potentiality, but cannot give them soil. India is an introverted consciousness. India says the outer doesn't exist. Even if it exists, it is of the same stuff as dreams are made of. The whole genius of India has been trying how to escape the outer, how to look to the inner cave of the heart, how to be centered in oneself, and how to come to realize that the whole world that exists outside your consciousness is just a dream, at the most beautiful, at the worst a nightmare, but in reality, whether beautiful or ugly, it is a dream. One should not bother much about it. One should awake and forget the whole dream of the outer world. The whole effort of Buddha, Mahavir, Tilopa, Gorakh, Kabir, the whole effort through the centuries is how to escape from the wheel of life and death, how to enclose yourself, how to completely cut yourself from all relationships, to be unrelated, detached, to move in and to forget the outer. That's why Zen was born in India. Zen means Dhyan. Zen is a Japanese change of the word Dhyan. Dhyan is the whole effort of Indian consciousness. Dhyana means to be so alone into your own being that not even a single thought exists. In fact, in English there is no word to translate it actually. Contemplation is not that word, because contemplation means thinking, reflection. Even meditation is not that word, because meditation involves an object to meditate upon. Something is there. You can meditate on Christ, or you can meditate on the cross. But dhyana means to be so alone that there is nothing to meditate upon. No object. Simple subjectivity exists. Consciousness without clouds, a pure sky. When the word reached China, it became Chan. When Chan reached Japan, it became Zen. It comes from the same Sanskrit root, Dhyana. India can give birth to dhyan for millennia. The whole Indian consciousness has been traveling on the path of dhyan. How to drop all thinking and how to be rooted in pure consciousness. With Buddha, the seed came into existence. Many times before also, before Gautam Buddha, the seed came into existence. But it couldn't find a right soil. It disappeared. And if the seed is given to the Indian consciousness, it will disappear. Because the Indian consciousness will move more and more inwards, and the seed will become smaller and smaller and smaller, and the moment comes, it becomes invisible. A centripetal force makes things smaller, 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 atomic, and suddenly they disappear. Many times before Gautam Buddha, the seed was born, because Gautam Buddha is not the first to meditate and to become a dhyani, to become a great meditator. In fact, he is one of the last of a long series. He himself remembers 24 Buddhas before him. Then there were Jaina Tirthankaras, 24. And they all were meditators. They did nothing else. They simply meditated, 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 and came to a point where only they were and everything else disappeared, evaporated. It was born with Parshvanath, with Mahavira, Neminath and others. But then the seed remained with the Indian consciousness. The Indian consciousness can give birth to a seed, but cannot become the right soil for it. It goes on working in the same direction. The seed becomes more and more smaller, molecular, atomic, and disappears. That's how it happened with the Upanishads. With Buddha also, it was going to happen. Bodhidharma saved him. If it was with the Indian consciousness, it would have dissolved. It would have never sprouted. Because a different type of soil is needed to sprout. A very balanced soil. Introversion is a very deep imbalance. It is extreme. Bodhidharma escaped with the seed to China. He did one of the greatest things in the history of consciousness. To find the right soil for the seed Sakyamuni Buddha has given to the world. Buddha himself is reported to have said that not more than 500 years my religion will exist, then it will disappear. He was aware, it has been happening always so. The Indian consciousness goes on grinding it into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. Then a moment comes, it becomes so small, it becomes invisible. It simply is no more part of this world. It disappears into the sky. Bodhidharma did a great experiment. He looked all around the world. He observed deeply where this seed can grow. China is a very balanced country. Not like India, not like Japan. The golden mean is the path. Confucian ideology is to remain always in the middle. Neither be extrovert nor be introvert. Neither think too much of this world nor too much of that world. just remain in the middle. China has not given birth to a religion, just morality. No religion has been born there. The Chinese consciousness cannot give birth to a religion. It cannot create a seed. And all the religions that exist in China are imported. They have all come from the outside. Buddhism, Hinduism, Mohammedanism, Christianity, they all have come. China is a good soil. It cannot originate any religion. Because to originate a religion, one has to move extremely into the inner world. To give birth to a religion, one has to be like a feminine body, a womb. The feminine consciousness is extremely introvert. A woman lives in herself. She has a very small world around her. The most minimum possible. That's why you cannot interest a woman into things of vastness. No. You cannot talk about Vietnam to her. She doesn't bother. It is too far away. Too outer. She is concerned with her family, her husband, the child, the dog, the furniture, the radio set, the TV. A very small world around her. Just the minimum. She doesn't have a very big world around. That's why it is very difficult for man and woman to talk intelligently. Because they live in different worlds. A woman is beautiful only when she keeps quiet. The moment she starts talking, then stupid things come out of her. She cannot talk intelligently. She can love, but cannot talk intelligently. She cannot be very philosophic. No, that's not possible. These things are too far away. She doesn't bother. She has a very small circle of her own world and she is the center. And whatsoever is meaningful only in concern to herself. Otherwise, it is not meaningful. She cannot conceive why you are bothered about Vietnam. What is the matter with you? You are not related at all. Whether it is happening, a war or not, it is no concern. And the child is ill and you are bothering about Vietnam. She cannot believe that she is present near you. And you are reading the newspaper. They live in different worlds. A woman is centripetal, introvert. All women are Indian. Wherever they are, that makes no difference. Man is centrifugal. He goes out. The moment he can find an excuse, he will escape from the home. He comes to the home only when he cannot go anywhere else. All doors are closed, clubs closed, hotels closed. Then what to do? He comes back home. Nowhere to go, he comes home. A woman is always home-centered, home-based. She goes out only when it is absolutely necessary. When she cannot do otherwise, When it has become absolute necessity, she goes out. Otherwise, she is home-based. Man is a vagabond, a wanderer. The whole family life is created by women, not by men. In fact, civilization exists because of women, not because of men. If he is allowed, he will be a wanderer. No home, no civilization. Man is outgoing, woman is ingoing. Woman is introvert, man is extrovert. He is always interested in something else than himself. That's why he looks more healthy. Because when you are too much concerned with yourself, you become ill. Man is more happy looking. Women you will find always sad. Too much concern with themselves. A little headache and they are too much concerned because they live inside. The headache becomes too much, out of proportion it looks. A man can forget the headache, he has too many other headaches. He creates so many around himself that there is no possibility to come upon his own headache and make something out of it. It is always so little, he can forget about it. A woman is always concerned something is happening in the leg, something in the hand, something in the back, something in the stomach, always. Because her whole consciousness is focused inwards. A man is less pathological, more healthy, more outgoing, concerned with others. What is happening to others? That's why in all religions you will find, if there are 5 persons present, 4 will be women and 1 man. And that man may have come because of some woman. Because the wife is going to the temple, what to do? He has to follow her. Or the wife is going to listen to a religious talk, so he has come just with her. In all churches, this will be the proportion, mass, churches, temples, wherever you go. Even with a Buddha, this is the proportion, Mahavir, this is the proportion. With Buddha there were 50,000 sannyasins, 40,000 women, 10,000 men. Why? Physically, men can be more healthy, women can be more spiritually healthy. Their concerns are different. When you are concerned with others, you can forget your body, you can be more physically healthy. But religiously, you cannot grow so easily. Because religious growth needs an inner concern. A woman can grow very, very easily into religion. That path is easy for her. To grow in politics for a woman is difficult. To grow in religion for a man is difficult. Introversion has its own benefits, extroversion has its own benefits and its own harms. And the same is true with the introvert mind also. India is introvert, a feminine country. It is like a womb, very receptive. But if a child remains in the womb forever and forever and forever, the womb will become the grave. The child has to move out from the mother's womb. Otherwise, the mother will kill the child inside. He has to escape to find the world outside, a greater world, womb may be very comfortable. It is. Scientists say we have not been able to create anything more comfortable than the womb. Yet, with so much scientific progress, we have not made anything more comfortable. Womb is just a heaven. But even the child has to leave that heaven and come outside the mother. The mother can become beyond a time very dangerous. It can kill. Because the womb will become then an imprisonment. Good for a time being when the seed is growing, but then the seed has to be transplanted to the outside world. Bodhidharma looked around, watched the whole world, and found that China is the best soil. It is just the middle ground, not extreme. The climate is not extreme, and the tree can grow easily. And very balanced people. Balance is the right soil for something to grow. Too cold is bad, too hot is bad. Just a balancing climate, neither too cold nor too hot, and the tree can grow. Bodhidharma escaped with the seed, escaped with all that the India has produced. Nobody was aware what he is doing, but he did a great experiment, and he proved right. In China the tree grew to vast proportions, but the tree became vaster and vaster with no flowers. Flowers were not coming. Flowers need an extrovert country, because just like seed is introvert, flower is extrovert. The seed is moving inwards, the flower is moving outwards. The seed is like feminine consciousness, the flower is like male consciousness. The flower opens to the outer world. It releases its fragrance to the outside world. The fragrance moves on the wings of the wind to the farthest corner of the world possible. To all directions, the flower releases the energy contained in the seed. Flower is a door. Flowers would like to become butterflies and escape from the tree. In fact, that's what they are doing in a very subtle way. They are releasing the essence of the tree, the very meaning, the significance of the tree to the world. They are great sayers. A seed is a great miser, confined to himself. A flower is a great spendthrift. Japan was needed. Japan is the extrovert country. The very style of life and consciousness is extrovert. Look, in India, nobody bothers about the outside world very much. About clothes, house, the way one lives, nobody bothers. That's why India has remained so poor. If you are not worried about the outside world, how can you become rich? If there is no concern to improve the outside world, you will remain poor. And India is always very serious. Always getting ready how to escape from life. Buddhas all talking about how to become perfect dropouts from existence itself, not only from society. Ultimate dropouts from existence itself. It is too boring. the existence. For the Indian eye, life is just like grey color. Nothing interesting in it. Everything just boring, a burden. One has to carry it somehow because of past karmas. Even if an Indian falls in love, he says because of past karmas. One has to pass through it. Even love is like a burden one has to drag. India seems to be more leaning towards death than life. An introvert has to lean towards death. That's why India has evolved all the techniques how to die perfectly. How to die so perfectly that you are not born again. Death is the goal, not life. Life is for fools. Death is for those who are wise. Howsoever beautiful a Buddha, a Mahavira may be, but you will find them closed. Around them, a great aura exists of indifference. Whatsoever happening is happening, they are not concerned at all. Whether it happens this way or that way makes no difference. Whether the world goes on living or dies makes no difference. A tremendous indifference. In this indifference, flowering is not possible. In this inner confined state, flowering is impossible. Japan is totally different. As if with the Japanese consciousness, the inner doesn't exist, only the outer is meaningful. Look at the Japanese dresses, all the colors of flowers and the rainbows. As if the outer is very meaningful. Look at Indian dresses of the ancient days. And look at the Japanese. Look an Indian when he is eating, and look at the Japanese when he is eating. Look at an Indian when he takes his tea, and the Japanese. The Japanese creates a celebration out of simple things, taking tea, and he makes it a celebration. It becomes an art. The outside is very much important. Even clothes are very much important. Relationship is very much important. You cannot find more outgoing people in the world than Japanese. Always smiling, looking happy. For the Indian, they will look sallow. Will not look serious. These are the introvert people and they are the extrovert. They are opposites. A Japanese is always moving in society. The whole Japanese culture is to how to create a beautiful society, how to create beautiful relationship. About everything, very minute things, but how to give them significance. Their house is so beautiful. Even a poor man's house has a beauty of its own, artistic, has its own uniqueness, may not be very rich, but is still rich in a certain sense because of the beauty, the arrangement. The mind that has been brought to every small, tiny detail, where the windows would be, what type of curtain should be used, how the moon should be invited from the window, from where. Very small things, but every detail is important. With the Indian, nothing matters. Even if you go to an Indian temple without any windows, nothing, no hygiene, no concern with air, ventilation, nothing. Even temples are ugly. And everything goes dirt, dust, and nobody bothers. Just in front of the temple, you will find cows sitting, dogs fighting, and people praying. Nobody bothers. No sense of the outer. Not at all concerned with the outer. Japan is too much concerned, just on the other extreme, with the outer. Japan was the right country. Then the whole tree of Zen was transplanted to Japan, and there it blossomed in 1,000 colors. It flowered. This is how it has to happen again. I am again talking about Zen. It has to come back to India, because the tree has flowered and the flowers has fallen, and Japan cannot create the seed. Japan cannot create the seed. It is not an introvert country. So everything has become an outer ritual now. Zen is dead in Japan. It did flower in the past, but now, if by reading in the books and reading D.T. Suzuki and others, you go in search of Zen to Japan, you will come empty-handed. Now, Zen is here. In Japan it has disappeared. The country could help to flower it, but now the flowers have disappeared, fallen to the earth. Nothing is there anymore. Rituals, because Japanese are very ritualistic, rituals exist. Everything in Zen monasteries is still continued, the same way as if the inner spirit is still there, but the inner shrine is vacant and empty. The master of the house has moved, the guard is no more there, just empty ritual, and they are extrovert people, they will continue the ritual. Every morning they will get up at 5, the gong will be there, they will move to the tea room, they will take their tea, they will move to their meditation hall and they will sit with closed eyes. Everything will be followed exactly as if the spirit is there, but it has disappeared. Monasteries are there, thousands of monks are there, but the tree has flowered. And seeds cannot be created there. Hence I am talking too much about Zen here. Because again only India can create the seeds. The whole world exists in a deep unity, in a harmony. In India the seed can be again given birth. But now many things have changed around the world. China is no more possible. It has become itself an extrovert country. It has become communistic. Now matter is more important than the spirit. And then it is closed now for new waves of consciousness. To me, now in the future, if any country can become again the soil, it is England. You will be surprised, because you may think it is America. No. Now in the world, the most balanced country is England. Just as in the ancient days it was China. The seed has to be taken to England, planted there. It will not flower there, but it will become a big tree. English consciousness, conservative, always following the middle way, the liberal mind, never moving to the extremes, just retaining in the middle, will be helpful. That's why I am allowing more and more English people to settle around me. It's not only for visa reasons. Because once the seed is ready, I would like them to take it to England. And from England, it can go to America and it will have a flowering there. Because America is the most extrovert country right now. I tell you that Zen is a rare phenomenon. Because all these situations fulfilled, only then such a thing happens. Now, try to understand the story. Somebody asked the master Bokoju, "We have to dress and eat every day. How do we get out of all that?" Bokoju answered, "We dress, we eat." He said, "I don't understand." Bokoju answered, "If you don't understand, put on your clothes and eat your food." These small anecdotes are very meaningful. Because Zen people say that the deeper that which arises in the depth of your being cannot be said, but it can be sowed. A situation can be created in which it can be hinted at. Words may not be able to tell anything about it. But a alive anecdote can tell it. That's why Zen is so much anecdotal. It lives in parables, indicates in parables. And nobody has been able to create such beautiful parables. There are Sufi stories, there are Hasid stories, and there are many others, but nothing to compare with Zen. Zen has simply the knack of hitting at the right thing and indicating that which cannot be indicated. And in such a simple way that you can miss it, you will have to search for it. You will have to grope for it. Because the anecdote in itself is so simple, you can miss it. It is not very complex. The mind is not required, in fact, rather than an opening of the heart, so you can understand the thing. See, this is small anecdote telling the whole significance of Zen. Somebody asked the master Bokoju, "We have to dress and eat every day. How do we get out of all that?" Had he asked the same thing to Buddha, the answer would not have been the same. The answer would have come from the seed mind. Buddha would have said, "All is illusory. Eating, dressing, everything is illusory. Become more aware. See the illusoriness and the dreaminess of the world. All is Maya. Become more aware and don't try to find how to get out of it. Because how one can get out of a dream? One simply becomes aware and one is out. Have you seen anybody ever getting out of the dream? Dream is unreal. How can you get out of it? The miracle is that in the first place, how you entered it. Because it is not there and you entered. And now you are creating more trouble for yourself, asking how to get out of it. The same way as you entered, get out of it. How you entered in a dream? By believing that this is real. That is the way how one enters into a dream. By believing that this is real. So simply drop the belief and see that this is not real. And you are out of the dream. There are no steps to get out, no techniques to get out, no methods. Buddha would have said that, look, the whole life is dream and you are out of it. If the Chinese genius Confucius was asked, the balanced mind, who is neither extrovert nor introvert, he would have said, there is no need to get out of it. Follow these rules and you will be able to enjoy it. Confucius would have given few rules, that these rules have to be followed, that's all. One need not get out of it. One simply has to plan his life in a right way. Even one has to plan the life of dream in a right way. Confucius says that even if in your dream you commit something wrong, you have to ponder over it. Somewhere in your waking hours, you are not following the right path. Otherwise, how in the dream you can go wrong? Settle something, balance something. That's why he has 3,300 rules. But in Japan, a totally different answer. With Buddha, the answer would have come from the seed. With Confucius, from the tree. From Bokuzu, it comes from the flower. Of course, these are different answers. Rooted in the same truth, but not using the same symbols, cannot use. What Bokuzu says is simply flower-like. It is the most perfect possibility. Bokuzu answered, we dress, we eat. Such a simple answer. Every possibility to miss. And you may think, what he is saying looks gibberish, nonsense. The man asks, we have to dress and eat every day. How do we get out of all that? And Bokuzu answers, we dress, we eat. What Bokuzu is saying, what he is indicating, a very subtle indication. He is saying, we also do it, we eat, we dress, but we eat so totally that the eater doesn't exist, only eating. We dress so totally that the dresser doesn't come into being, but only dressing. We walk, but there is no walker, just the walk. So who is this asking to get out of it? Look the vast difference. Buddha would have told that all this is dream. You're eating, you're dressing, you're walking. And Bokuju says, you are dream. Tremendous difference. Bokuju is saying, don't bring yourself in. Simply eat and walk and sleep. And who is this asking to get out of it? Drop this ego. It is non-existential. And when you are not, how can you come out of it? Not that walking is dream, but the walker is dream. Not that eating is dream, but the eater. And watch minutely. If you really are walking, is there any walker inside? Walking happens, it is a process. Legs move, hands move, you breathe more. The wind blows in your face, you enjoy. The faster you go, the more vitality you feel. Everything is beautiful. But is there really a walker? Is there somebody sitting inside? Or just the process exists? If you become aware, you will find only the process exists. The ego is illusory. It is just a mind creation. You eat and you think there must be somebody who eats. Because the logic says, how can you walk without a walker inside? How can you eat without an eater being there? How can you love without a lover being inside? This is what logic says, but if you have loved, and if you have come to a moment where really love existed, you must have known there was no lover inside, only love. A process, an energy. But nobody inside. You meditate. But is there any meditator? And when meditation comes to a flowering and all thoughts cease, who is there inside? Is there somebody who says all thoughts have ceased? If it is there, then still the meditation has not flowered. At least one thought is still there. When meditation flowers, simply there is nobody to take note of it. Nobody to give it recognition. Nobody to say, yes, it has happened. The moment you say, yes, it has happened, it is lost already. When really there is meditation, a silence pervades. Without any bounds, a bliss throbs. Without any boundaries, a harmony is there. But nobody to take note. Nobody to say that, yes, this has happened. That's why Upanishads say, when a person says, I have realized, you can know well that he has not. That's why all the Buddhas have said, whenever somebody claims, the very claim shows that he has not reached to the final peak. Because at the final peak, the claimer disappears. In fact, it has been never there. Eating is not dream. The eater is the dream. The whole emphasis has changed from the seed to the flower. That's why many people in the West think that to call Zen Buddhism is not good. Because vast difference is felt in their answers, but they are wrong. Zen Buddhism is absolute, pure Buddhism. Even purified of Buddha, purified of Buddhist concepts. It is the most essential, the purest dhyana, the purest flowering of consciousness. Without any center, you exist. Without there being anybody, you exist. You are, and still you are not. That's what Tilopa is emphasizing. No self, anatta, emptiness, void. What Bokuju says, we dress, we eat. Finished his answer. His answer is complete, perfect. He says simply, we eat and we dress, and we have never found any problem. And we have found never anybody who can come out. There is nobody inside. Eating exists, dressing exists, ego is not. Don't ask a foolish question, he is saying. The questioner said, I don't understand. He may have come to find some rules and disciplines, how to become a religious man, and how to drop out these tribal things of eating and dressing, and that same routine. Every day again and again one goes on doing the same thing. He must have been fed up, bored. Everybody comes to a point. If you are a little intelligent, you will have to come to a point when you will feel bored. Only idiots and sages are never bored. Otherwise, intelligent people are bound to get fed up. What is going on? Every day you go to sleep again just to get up in the morning, and then the breakfast, and then the going to the office, and this and that. And again, you know, this whole you are doing to go to sleep again. And you know well that in the morning again the same routine starts. One starts feeling robot-like. And if you become aware, as in India, people became aware in the past, that this has been going on for millions of lives. You are bound to feel completely bored to death. That's why they say how to get out of it. This wheel of life and death goes on grinding and grinding and grinding. And the same, just like a broken gramophone record, goes on repeating the same line. This has happened to you millions of times. You fell in love. You got married. You work hard. You gave birth to children. You struggled. You died again. And again. And again. And it goes on ad nauseam. That's why becoming aware of this phenomena of continuous rebirth, India became so bored. The whole consciousness became so fed up that the whole effort was it how to get out of it. That's what that man has come to ask Bokuju, that help me to get out of it. it is too much and I don't know from where to escape. Getting every day dressed, eating. How to get out of this dead routine, this rut? And says Bokoju, we dress, we eat. He says many things. He says there is nobody to get out. And if there is nobody, how can you get bored? Who will get bored? I also get up every day in the morning, take my bath, eat, dress, do everything that you do, but I'm not bored. I can go on doing it to the very end of eternity. Why I'm not bored? Because I'm not there, who is going to get bored? And if you are not there, who is going to say that it is a repetition? Every morning is new. It is not the repetition of the past. And every breakfast is new. Every moment is new and fresh, like the dew drops on the grass in the morning. It is because of your memory, collecting the past, carrying the past, and always looking at the fresh moment through the past, the dusty past. You feel bored. Bokoju lives in the moment and doesn't bring other moments to compare it. There is nobody who carries the past. There is nobody who thinks about the future. Only a life process, a river of consciousness, which goes on moving from moment to moment, always from the known into the unknown. Always from the familiar into the unfamiliar. So, who is there worried to get out of it? There is nobody. Bokoju says, we eat and we dress. And it is finished. We don't create a problem out of it. The problem arises because of the psychological memory. You always bring your past. You always bring it to compare and judge and condemn. If I show you a flower, you don't see it directly. You say, yes, this is a beautiful rose. What is the need to call it a rose? The moment you call it a rose, all the roses that you have known in the past have come into. The moment you call it a rose, you have compared it with other flowers. You have identified it. You have categorized it. The moment you call it a rose and the moment you call it beautiful, all your concepts of beauty, memories of roses, imaginations, everything has come in. The rose is lost in the crowd. This rose is lost in the crowd. This beautiful flower is lost into your memories and imaginations, concepts. And then you will get fed up. Because it will look like other roses. What is the difference? If you can look directly to this phenomena, to this rose, eyes fresh, empty of the past, consciousness clear, perception unclouded, doors open, words non-existent, if you can be here now, with this flower a little while. Then you will understand what Bokoju says, we dress, we eat. He is saying we do everything so totally in the present that we cannot feel it is a repetition. And because we are not there, who is to carry the past and who is to imagine the future? Absent, we exist. And then a different quality of presence happens to you. Moment to moment new, flowing, loose, natural. From one moment to another moment, one simply slips. Just as a snake sometimes slips out of the old skin. The old skin is left behind. He never looks back. He doesn't try to carry the old skin. A man of awareness simply slips from one moment to another. Just like a dew drop is slipping from the blood of the grass, not carrying anything. A man of awareness has no cargo. Unburdened he moves. Then everything is new. And then no problems are created. What Bokoju is saying is this, that it is better not to create a problem, because we have not known anybody to solve any problems ever. Once created, problems cannot be solved. Don't create them. That is the only way to solve them. Because once created, in the very creation, you have taken a false step. Now, whatsoever you do, that false step won't allow you to solve it. If you ask how to drop the ego, you have created a problem which cannot be solved. Thousands of teachers exist who go on teaching you how to be humble and how to solve it and how not to be egoist. Nothing happens. In your humility also you remain egoists. In your egonessness also you carry a subtle ego. No. Those who know, they will not help you to solve any problems. They will simply say, where is the ego? They will say, where is the problem in fact? They will help you to understand the problem, not to solve it. Because the problem is false. The answer cannot be right if the question is wrong. If the very question is rooted in wrong, then all answers given will be futile and they will lead you to more false questions. It will become a vicious circle. That's how philosophers become mad. Not looking at the wrongness of the question, they create an answer, and then the answer creates more questions. No answer solves anything. Then what to do? What Zen says? Zen says, look in the problem itself. There is answer hidden. Look in the question deeply, and if the look is perfect, the question disappears. No question is ever solved. They simply disappear. And when they disappear without any trace. He is saying, where is the problem? We also eat, we also dress, but we simply eat and dress. Why create the problem? Bokoju is saying, accept as life is. Don't create problems. One has to eat, eat. Hunger is there. You have not created it. It has to be fulfilled. Fulfill it. But don't create a problem. People come to me, and every day this is the whole situation. They bring their problems. And I have not come across a single problem, because there is none. You create it. And then you want an answer to it. And there are people who will give you answers. Those are small teachings. And there are people who will give you an insight into your problem, and that is the great teaching. And small teachings lead to forced disciplines, and great teachings allow you to become loose and natural. Bokuju says, we dress, we eat. But the man could not understand. Of course, it is difficult to understand such a simple thing. People can understand complex things. People cannot understand simple things. Because a complex thing can be divided, analyzed, logically tackled. But what to do with a simple thing? You cannot analyze it. You cannot cut into pieces. You cannot dissect it. There is nothing to dissect. It is so simple. And because it is so simple, you miss it. The man could not understand. But still, I think the man was very sincere, because he said, I don't understand. There are very complex people. They will nod their head. They will show that they have understood. These are greater fools. Nobody can help them, because they go on pretending that they understand. They cannot say that I don't understand. Because if they say this, they will look idiotic to themselves. They pretend. How can they not understand such a simple thing? They go on showing that they have understood. Now more complexities will arise. In the first place, there is no problem. And in the second place, they have understood the answer. Problem doesn't exist. And now they have gained knowledge about the problem. They said they understand. They become more and more puzzled and a mess inside. Such people come to me and I can see inside them just a mess, a hodgepodge. They have not understood anything. They have not understood even their problems, what they are, and they have answers. And not only that, they start helping others to solve their problems. That man must have been sincere. He said, I don't understand. This is a good step towards understanding. If you don't understand, you can understand. The possibility is open. You are humble. You recognize the difficulty. You recognize that you are ignorant. This is the first step towards knowing. Towards understanding, to recognize that I don't understand. At least this much he has understood, and this is a great step. Bhukuju answered, "If you don't understand, put on your clothes and eat your food." Bhukuju looks not very compassionate, but he is saying, "You cannot understand because the mind never understands. The mind is a great non-understander. The mind is the very root ignorance. Why the mind cannot understand? Because the mind is just a tiny part of your being. And the part cannot understand, only the whole can understand." Always remember this, that only your total being can understand anything, not any part. Neither your head can understand, nor your heart, nor your hands, nor your legs. Only your total being. Understanding is of the total. Misunderstanding is of the part. The part always misunderstands. Because the part tries to pretend as the whole. That is the whole problem. The mind tries to say that I am the whole understanding. And mind is just a part. You fall asleep, where is your mind? And the body continues without it. The body digests food. No need for the mind. Your brain can be taken out completely, and your body can continue. It will digest food. It will grow. It will throw out dead things out of the body. Now scientists have come to feel that mind is just a luxury. The body has its own wisdom. It doesn't bother about the mind. Have you ever observed that mind goes on playing as great knower without feeling at all in the least that all that is important goes without the mind in the body? You eat food. The body doesn't ask the mind how to digest it. And it is a very complex process. Not easy to transform food into blood. The body transforms, goes on working. It is a very complicated process because thousands of elements are involved. The body releases in right proportions juices which are needed to digest the food. Then it absorbs that which is needed for the body. It leaves that which is not needed. It throws out the excreta. In the body, every second, thousands of cells are dying. The body goes on throwing them out of the bloodstream. Millions of needs are there for hormones, vitamins, and millions of things. And the body goes on finding them from the atmosphere. When the body needs more oxygen, it takes deep breaths. When the body doesn't need it, it relaxes breathing. Everything goes on. Mind is just a part in this whole mechanism. And not very essential. Because animals exist, trees exist, and exist beautifully. But the mind is a great pretender. It simply pretends that mind is the base, the most foundational, the peak, the climax. It goes on pretending. You just watch your mind and you will see. And with this pretender you want to understand? This is the only false note within you. What Bokoju is saying, he says, if you don't understand, put on your clothes and eat your food. Don't bother about understanding. You be just like us, eat and dress. And don't try to understand. The very movement to understand creates misunderstanding. There is no need. You simply live and be. That's what Bokoju says. You eat and dress. You just be. Forget about understanding. What is the need? If trees can exist without understanding, what is the need for you? If the whole existence is there without understanding, why bother? Why bring this small, tiny mind and create problems? Relax and be. Bokoju is saying, the understanding comes from the total. You simply eat and don't try to understand. You simply move, walk, love, sleep, eat, take your bath, be total. Let things happen. You simply be. You don't try to understand them. Because the very effort to understand creates a problem. You become divided. Don't create the problem, just be. Try this sometimes. This is what I would like you to try. Sometimes go into the mountains for 3 weeks, just be. Don't try to understand anything. Just be naturally loose. When you feel like sleeping, go to sleep. When you feel like eating, eat. If you don't feel like eating, don't eat. There is no urgency. Just leave everything to the body, to the total. Mind is the creator of problems. Sometimes it says fast, when the body needs food. Sometimes it says eat more, because the food is very delicious. When the body says enough, wait, don't force anything anymore. You don't listen to the total. And the total is wise. In that total, your mind, your body, and all is involved. Not that I am saying cut off the mind, because that too will be unnatural. That too is a part. The mind will have its own place, its own proportion. But it should not be allowed to be the dictator. If it becomes the dictator, then it creates problems. And then it seeks solutions. And solutions create more problems. And you go on and on. And you will end in a madhouse. Mind's destiny is madhouse. Those who go fast, they reach, of course, earlier. Those who go slowly, they reach a little later. But everybody is in the queue. Mind's destiny is the madhouse. Because a part trying to pretend as the whole is already mad, insane. And all the religions have helped to create divisions in you. All the religions have helped the mind to become more and more dictatorial. They say, kill the body. And you don't understand what you are doing. And people start killing the body. Mind and body and soul, they all exist together, in a togetherness. They are a togetherness. Don't divide. Divisions are false. Divisions are political. And then, if you divide, the mind becomes the dictator. Because the mind is the most articulate part in the body. Nothing else is there in it. But it happens in life also. If a man is more articulate, he will become leader of man. If he can talk well, if he is an orator, if he can manipulate language, he will become the leader. Not that he was capable of becoming a leader. He was a good talker. He impressed people's minds. He was a good persuader, a good salesman. Articulate. That's why orators lead the world. Of course, they lead into more and more deeper mess. Because they are not leaders of men. They don't have any other quality than talk. So your parliaments are nothing but talking houses. People go on talking. And one who can manipulate language better becomes the head. That's why your parliaments or madhouses are not very different. They are the same. The quality of being total is totally different. It is not a question of being articulate. It is rather a question of giving every part its proportion. It is a harmony. To giving your life a harmonious rhythm, then everything exists in it. Then mind is also beautiful. Then it doesn't lead you to madhouse. Then your mind becomes the greater mind. The mind becomes the enlightenment. But your whole exists as a whole. You don't divide yourself. Your wisdom remains undivided. That's what Bokuju is saying, and that is what Zen is all about. That's why I say Zen is a rare phenomenon. No other religion has reached to such a great flowering. Because Zen has come to understand that the understanding is of the total. You eat, you sleep, you be natural, and you be total. And don't try to divide yourself, mind and body, soul and matter. Don't divide. With division comes conflict and violence. With division comes millions of problems, and then there is no solution. There is only one solution, that is to be whole again. To leave everything to the natural totality. Mind will be there, but its function will be totally different. I also use mind. I am talking to you. The mind is needed. For communication, mind is needed. In fact, it is a communication device. For memory, mind is needed. It is a computer. But to be, your whole is needed. In the body, and when I say body, I mean your whole, body, mind, soul. Everything has its own functioning. If I want to catch something, I will use my hands. If I want to move, I will use my legs. If I want to communicate, I will use my mind. That's all. Otherwise, I remain as a whole. And when I use my hands, my whole backs my hands. They are not used against the whole. with the cooperation of the whole. When I use my legs and walk, they are used by the cooperation of the whole. In fact, they are functioning, walking for the whole, not for themselves. I talk to you, communicate, I use the mind for the whole. Something I have in my whole being that I would like to communicate, I use my mind. I use my hand and my gestures. I use my eyes. But they are used by the whole. The whole remains the supreme. The whole remains the master. When parts become master, then you are falling apart. Then your togetherness will be lost. Says Bokoju, if you don't understand, there is no need. Don't be worried about it. You just go put on your clothes and eat your food. I don't know what that man did. But to you I also say, if you understand, beautiful. If you don't understand, go put on your clothes and eat your food. Because the understanding will come only as a shadow of your total being. Live life in its totality. And don't be afraid of the total life. Don't be a coward and don't try to escape to the mountains and the monasteries. I have given you sannyas to live in the world as totally as possible. Just by living totally in the world, you will transcend it. Suddenly you will come to know you are in the world but not of it. I bring you a totally new concept of sannyas. The old sannyas said, escape, renounce. I tell you, those who escape are cowards. And I tell you, those who escape are not total, not whole. And I tell you, those who escape are crippled. It is not for you. You live the life in its totality. You live it as wholly as possible. And the more whole you are, the more holy you will become. The quality of sacredness comes when one lives courageously, without fear, without hope, without desire. One simply slips from one moment to another, completely fresh and new. This is what sannyas is to mean for you. Sannyas is living life in its totality. Moment to moment, allowing it to happen without any conditions on your part. And then, if you can allow this much, life allows you a transcendence. Remaining in the valley, you become the peak, and only then it is beautiful. If you go to the peak, the valley is last, and valley has its own beauties. If you remain in the valley, the peak is last, and the peak has its own beauties. And I would like you to become a man of valley and peak both together. Remaining in the valley, be a peak. And then you will be able to understand what Zen is. Man is ignorant of the real. And it is difficult to know the real. Because to know the real, first you have to be the real. Only the same can know the same. Man is false. As man exists, he is the deep hypocrite. He is not real himself. His original face is completely lost. He has many faces. He uses many faces. But he himself is not aware of the original face, his own. Man is an imitator. He goes on imitating others. And by and by he completely forgets that he has his unique being. The real can be known only when you are real. It is a tremendous effort. Arduous is the path. So man tries a trick. He starts thinking about the real, philosophizing, theorizing, creating mental systems about the real. That is all what philosophy is. A trick of the mind to deceive oneself that one is ignorant, that one does not know the real. That's why philosophy is abound, and the whole world lives in concepts, theories. Hindus, Mohammedans, Christians, Jains, Buddhists, and millions of concepts are there. They are cheap. You need not change yourself. You need an ordinary intelligent mind. A mediocre mind will do. No higher IQ is needed. There is not any difficulty. You can adopt concepts and you can hide your ignorance from yourself. Philosophy is just a hiding method. One starts feeling that one knows without knowing at all. One starts feeling that one has arrived without even taking the first step. Philosophy is the greatest disease. And once you are caught in it, it is very difficult to come out of it. Because it is so deeply fulfilling to the ego. One feels hurt when one comes to know one's ignorance. And ignorance is total and absolute. You don't know anything at all. You are simply in dark ignorance. And this hurts. One would like to know something, at least something. And philosophy gives you consolation. That here are theories. If you have an ordinary intelligence, that will do. You can learn theories. You can have your own system, a philosophy. and then you are at ease. Then not only you know, you can teach others, you can advise others, you can go on showing your knowledge to others, and everything is settled, ignorance is forgotten. Philosophy means a logical construction about reality. It is about and about and about. It is never the real. Round and round it goes, just beating the bush around. But it never hits the center of the real. It cannot do that. It is not possible for philosophy. Why it is not possible? Because philosophy is based on logic, and reality is beyond logic. You have to understand it a little more. A logic is a search for consistency, and reality is not consistent, or it is so deeply consistent that even the opposite is not inconsistent to it. Reality is paradoxical. All the opposites meet and mingle and merge into it. It is so vast. Logic is narrow. Logic is like a road, narrow, goal-oriented. Reality is like the vast space, no goal, not going anywhere. It is already there, moving in all dimensions together. Logic is one-dimensional, reality is multidimensional. Logic says A is A and can never be B. And this is the consistency of logic. And in reality, A is A and always moves and becomes the B. Logic says life is life and can never be death. How life can be death? But in reality, life is every moment moving into death. Life is death. Logic says love is love and can never be hate. And love is every moment moving into hate, and hate moving into love. You love the same person and you hate the same person. Deeper the love, the deeper the hate. Hate and love are two aspects of the same coin. Can you hate a person without loving him? How can you hate a person without loving him? First you have to love, only then you can hate. Hate needs love as a first step. How can you become inimical to a person to whom you have never been friendly? Friends and foes are separate only in logic. In reality, they are together. If you search your hate deep, you will find love hidden. The moment you are born, death is also born with you. Birth is the beginning of death, and death is the culmination of birth. Says Heraclitus, God is life and death, summer and winter, hunger and satiety, good and bad, always both, and God is reality. If you look at reality, you will see all opposites meeting. Reality is contradictory. Logic is non-contradictory. Logic is clean. Plain. Simple. Reality is very complex. Reality is not like a logical syllogism or a mathematical problem. It has many dimensions and it is interrelated, and all contradictions are together. The day turns into night, the night again turns into day. The morning is nothing but the indication that the evening is coming. Youth becomes old age. Everything changes and becomes the opposite. Beauty turns and becomes ugly. This has to be understood deeply, because that is the basic difference between philosophy and religion. Philosophy is logical, religion is not. Religion is real, philosophy is logical. To understand philosophy is not difficult. To understand religion is almost impossible. Logic speaks plain language. Religion cannot speak. Because religion has to speak the language of the reality. Logic is a chosen fragment from reality by the mind. It is not total. Religion accepts the whole and wants to know it as it is. Logic is a mental construction. Philosophy, logic, science, all are mental constructions. They are all based on logic. Religion is the de-structuring of the whole mind. Philosophy is structuring out of the mind about the reality, creating a system and a structure. The mind remains there, and the mind helps you to choose, to project, to find. In religion, you have to de-structure mind. The reality remains as it is. You don't do anything to reality. You simply drop the mind, and then you look. Because if the mind is there, the mind won't allow you to look at the whole. The mind is obsessed with consistency. The mind cannot allow the contradictory. So whenever you reach near a person who is enlightened, your mind will be in difficulty. You will feel many contradictions in him. And your mind will say, this man says this, and then he contradicts. And sometimes he says this, and then again something else, and he is inconsistent. A religious man is by the very nature of the case is contradictory, has to be, because he is not in search of consistency, he is in search of the truth. He is in search of the real, and he is ready to drop everything for the real, whatsoever the real is. He has no pre-formulated structure for the real. He has no idea how the real should be. If it is inconsistent, it is inconsistent. Okay. He has nothing to impose on it. A religious mind simply allows the real to reveal itself. He has no idea how it should be. A religious man is passive. A logical, philosophical, scientific man is aggressive. He brings some idea, and through that idea he structures reality. Around the idea, he tries to discover the real. The idea won't allow you to discover the real. The very idea is the hindrance. So one path is logic. Another path is poetry. Poetry is against logic. Logic is rational, poetry is irrational. Logic is logical, poetry is imagination. And this distinction has to be remembered, because religion is neither, nor logic nor poetry. Logic is also of the mind, and imagination is also of the mind. A poet imagines reality. Of course, his reality is more colorful than logician's reality, because he imagines, and he is not afraid. He is completely free in his imagination. He has not to follow any idea. He simply dreams about reality. But it is again about, he dreams about reality. He makes a beautiful whole out of his dreaming. He is colorful, because deep down is fantasy. Logic is plain, colorless, almost gray. No poetry in it, because no imagination in it. Poetry is almost contradictory, because it is imagination, it doesn't bother. You never ask the poet to be consistent. If a poet writes one poetry today, another tomorrow, and contradicts himself, nobody bothers. People say this is poetry. If a painter paints a certain thing today and just the opposite tomorrow, you don't ask for any consistency. You don't say what you are doing. Yesterday you painted the moon yellow, and today you are painting the moon reddish. What are you doing? You are contradictory. You know, nobody asks. It's poetry. Painting is poetry. Sculpture is poetry. You allow the poet all freedom. But poetry is imagination. Mind has two centers. One is thinking, another is imagination. But both centers are of the mind. A religion is beyond both centers. It is not of the mind at all. It is neither science nor poetry. Or it is both. That's why religion is a deeper mysticism than any poetry. It simply drops the mind with all its centers and then looks. It is just as if sometimes you put your glasses aside and look. Mind can be put aside because it is a mechanism. You are not the mind. The mind is just like a window. You are standing there and looking through the window. Then the frame of the window becomes the frame of reality. You look from the window. The moon has arisen and the sky is beautiful, but your sky will be framed by the window. And if the window has certain glasses, color, then your sky will be colored by the window. Religion is simply coming out of the house completely, looking at reality not through any window, not through any door, not through any glasses, not through any concepts, but simply looking as it is, putting aside the mind. Difficult, because you are so much identified with the mind that you have completely forgotten that you can put it aside. But this is the whole methodology of religion. The whole yoga, tantra and all the techniques of meditations are nothing but how to put the mind aside. How to break the identity with the mind and then look. Then whatsoever is reality is revealed. That which is revealed. As a member of this, so sometimes religion will speak the language of logic. Then it becomes theology. Sometimes religion will speak the language of the poetry. Then it becomes objective art. Like Taj Mahal. If you go and watch the Taj Mahal for the first time, you will understand what objective art is. Looking at a piece of an objective art like Taj Mahal, if you simply sit and watch and look, suddenly a silence surrounds you. A peace descends upon you. The very structure of Taj Mahal is related to your innermost being. Just looking at the shape of it, something changes within you. There are two types of art. One art is subjective, for example, Picasso. If you look at a Picasso painting, you can understand what type of mind Picasso must have been, because his own mind he pictures, paints, and he must have been living in nightmares, because all his painting is nightmares. You cannot look at it for long. You will feel ill and nausea. It is his inner madness that he has brought in color. It is infectious. This is subjective art. You bring your own mind, whatsoever you do. The objective art is not bringing your own mind, but following some objective rules to change the person who will look at it, meditate on it. The whole Eastern art has tried to be objective. The painter is not involved in it. The painter is forgotten. The sculpture is forgotten. The architect is forgotten. He is not involved in it. He is simply following certain objective rules to create a piece of art. For centuries, whenever somebody will look at it, something of meditation will happen in him. Suddenly time will disappear. In a full moon night, sitting near the Taj Mahal, not talking, just meditating on it, time disappears. A no time moment happens. And suddenly Taj Mahal is not there outside. Something is changing within you. Sometimes religion talks in terms of objective art to bring the reality into this world of the mind. Sometimes it talks in terms of logic, then it becomes theology. Then it argues. But these are both compromises with the world. Compromises with the ordinary, mediocre mind. Bridging religion to the ordinary mind. But when religion speaks in its purity, it is paradoxical. Like the Tao Te King of Lao Tse. Are the fragments of Heraclitus, are these Zen stories. In its purity, religion is transcendental to logic, to imagination, both. It is the very beyond. Now, a few things about the very beyond, then we can enter into this story. It is small, like a seed, but if you allow it, the soil of your heart, it can grow in a vast tree. It is small, if you look at the form, but if you look at the formless hidden in it, it has no limits, it is infinite. Something to be aware about the very beyond. First, the very beyond, the transcendental, needs a transformation in you. Otherwise, you will not be able to understand it. It needs a clarity of perception in you. It is not a question of intellect alone. Even a genius may not be able to understand it. And sometimes even an ordinary villager may be able to understand it. Sometimes even an Einstein may miss it. Because it is not a question of cleverness, intelligence. It is a question of clarity, not cleverness. Clarity is different. Cleverness is a way of being cunning with reality. It is cunningness. Clarity is completely different. It is not cunningness. It is innocence. Childlike. You don't have a mind. The window is completely open. You don't have any ideas. Because eyes, when filled with ideas, lose their clarity. It is just the sky filled with clouds. mind filled with thoughts is not transparent. It is a junkyard. And through it, that junkyard, you cannot come to realize what reality is. One has to clean oneself. A deep cleansing is needed. One has to pass through many meditations so that by and by your mind becomes clear, like a clear sky with no clouds. Only then. So it is not a question of intellectual understanding, it is a question of a different type of being. A being who is clear, like a clear sky. Second thing to remember is, a religious mind never goes beyond the moment. Because the moment you go beyond the moment, you have started working through the mind. If you think of the future, future is not here. So how can you look at the future? You can only think. You can only think about the future. You cannot see it. Only the present moment can be seen. It is already here. So the religious mind lives in the moment. You cannot force the religious mind to go beyond the moment. Because the moment the religious mind thinks about the future, it is no more religious. Immediately the quality of the mind has changed. Religious mind exists here and now. And that is the only way to exist. If you think about the future, the moment that is not here, you are already in the trap of the mind and you have allowed thoughts to form. In the present there is no thought. Have you ever observed this? That right now, how can thought exist? No, thought never exists in the present. It always exists for the future or for the past. Either you think of the past, then there is imagination. Or you think of the future, then there is logic. How can you think of the present? You can only be. And the moment is so subtle and so small, so atomic, that there is no space for any thought to exist in it. Thought needs space, needs room. There is no room for thought. Only being can be there. So whenever you are in the present, thinking stops. Or, if you stop thinking, you will be in the present. A religious mind is not concerned about future. Is not concerned about what happened in the past. It lives in the moment. And it moves from moment to moment. When this moment disappears, another moment comes, the religious man has moved into it. He is river-like. One very, very deep thing to be remembered, that a religious mind, a religious man, religious being, is always a process. It is always moving. Of course, the movement is unmotivated. It is moving not for any goal. It simply moves because movement is the nature of reality. Movement is the nature of reality. It moves with reality. Just as somebody floats with the river, he moves with the river of time. Each moment he lives and moves. He is not doing anything. He simply lives the moment. When the moment is gone, another has come. He lives that moment. A religious man has a beginning but no end. Awakening has a beginning but no end. It goes on and on and on. And just the opposite is the case with ignorance. Ignorance has no beginning but an end. Can you say when your ignorance is started? It has no beginning. When Buddha's ignorance is started, it has no beginning. But it has an end. It ended on a certain full moon night, 25 centuries before. Ignorance has an end, no beginning. Enlightenment has a beginning, no end. And that's how the circle becomes complete. When an ignorant man becomes enlightened, the circle is complete. Ignorance has no beginning but the end. Enlightenment has the beginning and no end. Now the circle is complete. Now, here is the perfect being whose circle is complete. But this perfection doesn't mean any staticness, because enlightenment has no end. It goes on and on and on for eternities, forever. Now, try to understand this beautiful seed light story. An ex-emperor asked the master Gudo, "What happens to a man of enlightenment after death?" Gudo replied, "How should I know?" The ex-emperor said, "Why?" "Because you are a master." Said Gudo, "Yes, sir, but not a dead one." An ex-emperor asked the master Gudo, "What happens to a man of enlightenment after death?" If he had asked philosophers, they would have supplied many answers. Scriptures are full with answers. What happens to an enlightened man after death? Buddha was asked again and again the same question. And he will simply laugh sometimes. Once it happened, it was evening, and a small earthen lamp was burning near Buddha, and somebody asked the question that what happens to a man of enlightenment after death. Buddha put the light off and asked, what happens now to the flame which is no more? Where it has gone? Where it is now? Just a moment before it was here. Now where it has gone? The same happens to the man of enlightenment. This is not an answer. The man must have gone unsatisfied. Buddha is avoiding. Those who have known have always avoided. But those who don't know, they have many answers. Scholars, pundits, you ask them and they will supply many answers. You can choose any of your liking. Guru replied, how should I know? You are asking something of the future and I am here and now. And for me there is no future. Only this moment exists. There is no other moment. That's why Guru says, how should I know? You are talking about death, death of an enlightened person. Somewhere in the future. Or somewhere in the past. What happened to Buddha? Guru says, I am here and now. No past is meaningful for me, no future. He is saying, look at me right now. The enlightened being is before you, Guru is saying, look at me. Why you are concerned? It happened once that a man came to meet Guru. He was a very famous master. And the man was very old, near about 90. And he belonged to a particular Buddhist sect. And he said, I have come from very far and my life is almost coming to an end. And I was always waiting a chance to meet you, because Guru was known all over the country as the master of the emperor. Before I die, I have come to you. I have to ask you one question. For almost 50 years, I have been studying scriptures. And I have come to know everything. Only one thing disturbs me. In my scripture it is written that even trees and rocks will become enlightened. That I could never understand. Trees and rocks. Guru said, tell me one thing. Have you ever thought about yourself? That can you become enlightened or not? The man said, it's strange. But I must confess, I never thought about it. Trees and rocks, how they can become enlightened? He has been thinking for 50 years. And he has come from far away to ask this question to Guru. And he has never thought about himself. People talk about death. Not knowing that right now you are alive, live it totally. Life is here, first know it. Why you talk about death? People talk about what will happen after death. It will be better to think what is happening to you right now after birth. And when death comes, we will meet it. First meet life that is here now. And if you can meet life, you will become capable of meeting death also. One who can live rightly will die rightly. One who has lived a total rich life of moment to moment moving, living, aware, conscious. Of course, when death comes, he will do the same with death. He will live it. Because he knows the quality how to live in the present. When death becomes the present, he will live it. But people are more concerned about death, less concerned about life. And if you cannot know life, how do you suppose that you will be able to know death? And death is not separate from life. It is the very culmination of it. If you miss life, you will not be able to see death. Death will come, but you will be unconscious. That's what is happening. People die in deep unconsciousness, coma. They lived their whole life in unconsciousness. When you treated life with unconsciousness, how do you suppose you will be able to be conscious before death? And life is 70, 80 years process. And you could not become aware even in 80 years. And death will happen in a single moment. Eighty years were not enough for you to become conscious. 1 second, how you will be able? Only a person who has lived moment to moment will be able to see death. Because he has lived even life moment to moment. Even death cannot escape him. He has the clarity. Such intense clarity that even in a single moment death comes and moves, he will be able to see it. One who has been able to see life will automatically be able to see death. And then one knows one is neither life nor death. One is just the witness. And when a person asks what happens to a man of enlightenment after death, he himself is not enlightened. From his deep ignorance he is asking. It is difficult to say. It is just a blind man asks. What happens when sun rises in the morning? How to explain to him? How to make the communication? It is impossible. It once happened. A man was blind, and not only blind, he was a great philosopher. The whole village was disturbed by him because he proved logically that there is no light. Because he said, I have hands, show me where light is, I can touch and feel. If something exists, it can be touched. If something exists, it can be tasted. If something exists, he said, you hit something against it, I can hear the sound. And the villagers were very much disturbed because they couldn't gather any proof. He had four senses, and he said, I have four senses. You bring light before me and I will see through my four senses whether it is there or not. And they said that because you are blind, you cannot see. And he laughed and he said, it seems that you are dreaming. What are eyes? And how can you prove that you have eyes and I don't have? And you tell me about your light, what it is. Explain it to me. They couldn't do that. It was impossible. But they felt very much depressed because this man is blind and they have eyes and they know the light is, but how to explain to a blind man? Then Buddha came to the town and they all took this mad philosopher, the mad blind man, to Buddha, and they asked Buddha that you try to explain to him, we have failed. And this man is something. He has proved that light is not there because it cannot be touched, cannot be smelled, cannot be tasted, cannot be heard. So how it can exist? Now you have come and you can explain to him. Buddha said, you are fools, because light cannot be explained to a blind man. The very effort is absurd. But I know one man who is a great physician. You take this man to him and he will treat his eyes. The man was taken to the physician, the eyes were treated. He was not really blind. Within 6 months, he started seeing. Then he came running to Buddha. Now he was in another town. He fell on his feet and he said, yes, now I know light is. And now I also know why those poor villagers could not prove it. And now I also know that you did well to send me to a physician. I needed treatment, not philosophy, not theories about light. When an ignorant person asks, what happens to an enlightened person after death? Leave that apart. What happens to an enlightened man while he is alive? Even that cannot be explained. That cannot be explained. What has happened to me? How I can explain it? No possibility. It is impossible. Unless you start seeing. Unless your eyes open. Unless you are changed. Nothing can be explained. The communication is not possible because enlightenment is totally a different quality of being. And you are completely blind to it. You can believe that I am enlightened, but you cannot see it. That belief will help. Because that belief will allow you to remain open. That trust will help. But you can deny. You can say, no, I cannot believe. How I can believe? How can I trust when I don't know? That will close you. Then there is no possibility. That's why religion insists on trust, Shraddha. The blind man can only believe on trust, that people say light exists. And if he trusts, then the possibility is there. If he does not trust, then he will not allow even the treatment. He will say, what you are doing? There is no light and there is no possibility of eyes, and I don't believe. So please, don't waste your time and don't waste my time. It is impossible to communicate from one plane to another plane. It doesn't function at all. You have to rise up to another plane of being. Only then suddenly you can see. And when you see an experience, then the trust is fulfilled. But before you see, one has to be in faith, to be in trust, just to allow the transformation. Guru replied, how should I know? Death has not come yet. When it comes, then I will know. And I will inform you. But right now I don't know. An enlightened person will not give you theories. He would like to give you insight, not theories. Insight is a deep phenomena within you. Theory is just borrowed. He could have replied, because there are theories what happens to the enlightenment. Some said he reaches to a plane called moksha, where he lives forever and ever. Some are more colorful. They say he reaches to the kingdom of God and lives with God forever and ever, just like Jesus sitting by the throne of God on the right hand, and angels dancing and singing and celebration goes on and on. And there are millions of theories, but they are all created by theologians just to console people. You ask, somebody has to give you the answer. But not by enlightened persons. They have remained silent about it. They are not concerned at all. Jesus says, consider the lilies of the field. They exist only here and now. They don't bother about the tomorrow. The tomorrow will take care of itself. Somebody brought the New Testament to a Zen master, and he read a few sentences from it. Particularly this sentence, when he read, consider the lilies in the field. They toil not. They don't think of the morrow. And they are so beautiful in the here and now that even Solomon, the great emperor, in his peak glory, was not arrayed in such beauty. The Zen master said, stop, whosoever said this is a Buddha. he didn't know about Jesus. He didn't know about Christianity. Christianity has reached Japan just few days before. The master said, "Stop, no more to say anything. Whosoever said this is a Buddha." All enlightened persons have insisted to remain with the moment. That's why I say, "Guru, how should I know?" The ex-emperor said, "Why? Because you are a master. From a master, we expect answers. And in fact, a master never gives you an answer, he simply destroys your questions. Vast difference is there between these two things. From a master, we expect answers of our questions. Questions are foolish, answers cannot be better. How can you answer a foolish question in a wise way? The very question is foolish. Somebody comes and asks, "What is the taste of green color?" It is absurd, because there is no relationship. But the question looks perfect. Linguistically, it is perfect. You can ask, "What is the taste of green color?" There is no error in the language, in the formulation. The same is the case when somebody asks, "What happens to an enlightened person when he is dead?" For many reasons. First, he is never dead. An enlightened person is one who has come to know the eternal life. He is never dead. Second, an enlightened person is no more a person. His ego is dissolved. That's why he is enlightened. So, in the first place, he is never dead. In the second place, he is already dead. Because he is no more. Buddha moves for 40 years after his enlightenment. And it is said that in those 40 years, while he was wandering from village to village, talking to people continuously for 40 years, giving them whatsoever he has attained, it is said he never uttered a single word and he never took a single step. What do you mean? And it is rightly said that he never uttered a single word because he is no more. How can you utter a word when you are not? As if existence himself, not Buddha, uttered those words. Because Buddha is no more a person now. Just the name has remained utilitarian. Otherwise there is no need, functional. He has never taken a single step and he was wandering and wandering. The whole province of Bihar is called Bihar because of his wanderings. Bihar means the wandering. Because he was wandering there, the whole province is known as Bihar. But it is said he never took a single step, and it is right, absolutely right, he never took a single step. I tell you, I continuously talk to you and I have not uttered a single word. When the ego is not there, who can utter? Then what is happening when I am talking to you? It is just like breeze passing through the trees. It is just like a spring moving towards the river. It is just like a flower opening, but I am not there. So the flower cannot claim that I opened myself. The breeze cannot say, because the breeze has no ego in it to say, that I passed through these trees. The river cannot say that I am moving towards those. The river moves, but there is nobody who is moving. I talk to you, but I have not uttered a single word. But how to communicate these things? An enlightened person is already dead. The past has disappeared. The center is no more there. Now he is nowhere. He exists everywhere. Now he is one with the whole. The wave has lost itself into the ocean. So when you see Buddha standing, that is just a contact point, that's all, that body. Nothing else. Just like a plug of the electric energy. Just you plug there and the energy moves, otherwise the energy is everywhere. So when Buddha is standing, he is just a contact point for the cosmos. He is no more there. Just a passage. Just an anchor into this world. And when the anchor is lost, that is what, when Buddha's body will drop, you ask what happens? When a wave is no more, what happens? It becomes the ocean. When a Buddha is no more, the body is disappears. The wave has disappeared. Buddha is already dead. That's why he is a Buddha. And secondly, he can never die. Because once the ego is lost, the eternal life is attained. Now Buddha is not anywhere, he will be everywhere. When you don't have a center, the whole existence becomes your center. The question is foolish. Looks logical, meaningful, but is foolish. That's why Guru replied, how should I know? Many things are implied. Guru is saying, I am not. Who should know? When the wave disappears in the ocean, how should I know? The ex-emperor said, why? Because you are a master. We expect answers from a master. Answers are given by teachers, not by masters. Masters simply destroy your mind. Even if it appears that they are answering you, they never answer. They are elusive. You ask something, they talk something else. You ask about A, they talk about B. But they are very persuasive, seductive. They talk about B and they convince you that yes, your question is answered. But your questions are foolish, they cannot be answered. They are irrelevant. So a master never answers the questions. He gives you the feeling that he is answering you, but he is simply trying you to pull the earth beneath your feet. The whole effort is that your mind falls, collapses. If you can be near a master for a little while, you will collapse. He is a chaos. You will be pulled down completely. Neither questions will be there nor answers. Only then, when silence exists in you, a master has succeeded with you. Answers will fill your mind again. So how a master can give you answers? They will be theories. They won't allow you to enter in reality. A master really cuts your questions, and by and by you stop asking, and a moment comes of no asking. Only then the answer is given. But that answer is not verbal. That answer is from his very being. Then the master pours himself into you. He is a vehicle. Then the whole pours through him unto you. Why? Because you are a master. We think that a master must be very knowledgeable. He must know everything. In fact, a master knows nothing. He has attained to perfect ignorance. Because only ignorance can be innocent, knowledge never. Knowledge is always cunning. It can never be innocent. Perfect ignorance. He does not know anything. Knowledge has dropped. He is, but he is not a knower. And whatsoever he says is out of his innocence, not out of his knowledge. He can say millions of things because innocence is so potent. He can go on and on for years. 40 years Buddha talked, and now scholars say that it seems impossible how one man can talk for 40 years. And so many things, it seems difficult for them because they don't know that innocence is inexhaustible. Knowledge will exhaust. If I know something, it is limited. Then I cannot go on and on and on. And I tell you, if you are ready, I can go on and on for eternity. Because it is not out of knowing, but out of perfect ignorance. Perfect ignorance is not your ignorance. Your ignorance is not perfect. You know. In fact, you know too much. You cannot find an ignorant person who doesn't know. He may know less, more, but he knows. He may know wrongly or rightly, but he knows. Even an idiot knows and insists that he knows rightly. Only an enlightened man denies that he knows. Said Socrates, that when I was young, I knew many things. In fact, I knew all. Then I became a little more mature, and I started feeling that I don't know much, very little. And when I became very, very old, then I understood the whole thing. Now I know only one thing that I don't know. And while he was young, he knew many things. Youth is arrogant. Only immature persons are knowledgeable. Maturity is like ignorance. It doesn't know, or it knows only this much. Says Godo, how should I know? Why? Because you are a master. Answers are expected. You must know. If you don't know, then who else will know? beautiful is Guru. Said he, yes sir, but not a dead one. I am a master, but not a dead one. Wait, when I am dead, then I will answer that what happens when an enlightened person dies. I am yet alive and you ask me about death. It has not happened. So how I should know? When it happens, I will report to you. It never happens to an enlightened man. Guru is really clever. It never happens to an enlightened man. Only ignorant people die. Only the egos die. When there is no center inside you, who can die? How death is possible? Death is possible to the ego, to the self. How death can happen to the no self? All the enlightened people through the ages have been saying only one thing: die to the ego so that you can attain to the eternal. Let the ego die, then there will be no death for you. You become deathless. Enough for today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.